Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. You're listening to Corner Office. It's a podcast from Marketplace. This time, I'm talking to Phil Knight, the co-founder and chairman of the company, about how he founded what is today a global brand. It starts in 1962. He's 24 years old. He goes to Japan. He works with a company named Tiger to import their shoes. Suffice it to say, it's good for about 8 years, and then it kind of goes south, which is where we get the Nike brand we know today. Anyway, he's got a new book out where he talks about everything from founding the company to building a sneaker company into an athletic lifestyle giant. It's a memoir called The Shoe Dog by Phil Knight.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Phil Knight, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So do me a favor, set the scene. You're 24 years old, it's 1962, and you go to Japan to talk about buying and importing running shoes at a time when running in this country just wasn't all that, right?
Yeah, it wasn't all that to the masses. But it was a lot to me and right. A lot of the people that I knew.
You came out of a running background. You ran at Oregon and you had aspirations, right?
Yeah. Well, my running aspirations were pretty well dead by then, but I had been around a lot of great runners. I loved the sport and I still ran for recreation.
Then what was it about shoes? Was it a way to keep connected to that sport?
Well, you know, in basketball, it's about the ball itself. In running, the only equipment that really matters, at least the mentality was in those days, were the pair of shoes that you wore. And the coach that I had thought an ounce and a pair of shoes was worth 10,000 pounds in the last 10 yards of a mile. So the importance of shoes was drummed into me for several years.
Talk to me about that coach for a minute, because he was quite the figure in your life and in this book, Bill Bowerman.
Yep. Well, he's a very complicated man. I've always said that he's describing Bill Bowerman as like the four Indian blind men trying to describe an elephant. But so it's difficult to describe him anything short of 410 pages, which Kenny Moore did. But he was like a second father in many ways and a great leader and a huge role model in my life.
You formed this company with him on a handshake.
Yep.
And a little bit of lawyering, I guess, right?
Well, that followed. that I don't think it was committed to paper for about 2 years, and then it was amended about a year later, and I don't think either one of us looked at the document after that.
First year Nike's in business, which back then was called Blue Ribbon. I mean, Nike was a decade and a half off. You did, like, what, $8,000 worth of sales out of the back of your car, right?
That was 1964, the first year. $8,000 in sales and $234 of profit.
The thing that got me about this book, and it continues almost to the last page, like until the day you guys went public, it seemed like you were scrapping and struggling and running out of money every single day.
It was so much fun.
Well, no, it reads well, but come on. I mean, right?
No, it was every day you went to work, you knew what you did mattered. And it was you're around a lot of people you liked in a business that you liked, and it was very tense. We would go off for these offsite meetings and try and figure out how we could conquer the world in 1 hour, and the next hour we'd worry about meeting payroll on Monday.
And you worked a bunch of day jobs, too, as you were starting this company. You were in the Army Reserves. You were a professor of, I guess, accounting. You were actually a CPA, an accountant. When did you decide that you had to go all in with this company?
Well, I knew I wanted to go all in from the day I walked into the shoe factory in Japan. But it was a kind of a question whether I could make it work or not. And in those days, I think the studies at Stanford indicated 26 out of 27 new companies failed every time they tried. So the odds were 1 in 27 that I might make it. But I thought the idea was worthy, and the professor thought it was worthwhile. But in many ways, that I didn't want to spend a lot of money on overhead, so I kind of was the overhead doing it nights and weekends, and the sales guys were out there selling.
Was there a time or a moment you knew that it was going to be all right?
Oh, I'm sort of a worrier by nature, and I'm not even sure about that today. I worry about everything.
You did this at a time when there was no venture capital. There was no, you know, there were no incubators. There was no nothing. Easier or harder to start a company today, do you think?
Well, I think it's easier. I think the venture capital side of it makes it a lot easier.
Do you envy entrepreneurs today, people starting out?
Oh, I have absolutely no regrets. I wouldn't trade places with anybody. It's the greatest journey I could have imagined. I've often said, if this is a dream, don't wake me.
this is a little touchy question, but I'm going to throw it out there and I'm going to see what you say. This book you're pretty honest in this book, and I got to tell you, you do not come across as the world's greatest boss.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you, but I think some people would dispute it. So I don't know. I did the best I could do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're transferring people across the country right and left. You're not responding to letters. Were you surprised that people stuck with you?
Not really. Basically, the bonds were really strong. And the people, I didn't make them go across the country. They ultimately decided they would do that. And we had a mission. And for a guy to move from Portland, Oregon to New Hampshire, well, of course, that's what was needed. Or even later on to Germany.
Yeah. There's a stress relief mechanism you use throughout this book, and it pops up probably every couple of pages. Every night after work, you go on a 6-mile run.
Mm-hmm.
What did that run, what did that time, what did that headspace mean to you?
Yeah, well, in those days, I could run pretty good, so it only took about half hour. And it was very, very important. I've often said that was as important as eating and sleeping.
Hmm. Did you have design sort of approval when you were starting up this company? Were you the guy saying, yes, let's make it yellow, and I want these soles to be this way, and I want the, you know, the branding over here?
Yeah, a lot. In the original days, we were working with Onitsuka Company Limited, which made Tiger Shoes. We were just distributing their shoes. So when we started out, we were kind of taking their stuff off the shelf, and then we would modify it a little bit. We didn't emphasize color so much, but we did have functional aspects that we put into it with nylon uppers and cushioned midsoles. And that was done. Bowerman had a lot of influence on that, and then just the people we communicated with in the running community.
Yeah.
But when we switched to Nike, that basically the original line I designed on a Sunday afternoon in Nishoiwa offices in Tokyo, Japan.
Wow. You have to. The iconic story about Nike, of course, is Bill Bowerman, like in his garage or something, pouring rubber into a waffle iron, and that's how you get the waffle soles. That doesn't come until page 194 of this book, which kind of amazed me. There was a whole bunch of stuff going on in this company before you found the magic thing, I guess.
Well, there was a lot of struggle before page 194, that's for sure.
What was the toughest thing then?
Well, I think the biggest crisis was when we switched from Tiger to Nike. That was the 1 year that the company had a loss. And it was a really pretty touch and go. So it was the tensest time, I think, during the company. Although, as if you've read the book, there were a lot of other tense times.
Yeah, there was a lot of tension. I mean, I got to tell you, it's a good read, and I enjoyed it. You go year by year in your chapter markings, and I want to ask you about 1975. It's about a 3-page chapter total, and the only thing in it is Steve Prefontaine. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Steve Prefontaine, what he meant to this company, and who he was and what he meant to this company and to you.
Well, I've often said that Prefontaine is sort of the soul of the company, that he was our first big running endorsement, that he was an Oregon kid. He captured the imagination of certainly American distance running. He had a ferocious style that we like to think was an example for what we wanted the company to be. My wife and I, before we got married, we used to go down to track meets in Eugene and watch him run. He was really interwoven with the company and with me personally. And so it was a great ride, and then all of a sudden it ended very tragically.
He dies in a car crash, right?
Yep, a very sad day.
What's the best thing that happened to you in the running of this company?
Oh, I think there are a lot of great moments, but I would, first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question is shaking hands with Bill Bowerman and becoming partners with him.
Hmm. There's a Fortune magazine article from 1984 that talking about you, and it says this: there is no better example that Nike has lost its way than they paid $250,000 for a North Carolina basketball player. The Nike Jordan brand goes on to make like $2 billion. What did you see that nobody else did?
Well, we knew he was a great player and an exciting player, and had a lot of heart. We knew he was going to be an outstanding player, and was a good risk as far as his character. Say that we knew he was going to be as great as he was would be a lie.
Could you have done it without celebrity endorsements, actually, now that we're on Michael Jordan and Tiger and all the rest?
Well, I think that's part of the business. I think if nobody has celebrity endorsements, we'd have been fine. But if we wouldn't have had celebrity endorsements and other people do, I don't think we could have made it, no.
How much does it mean to you that you are bigger now than Adidas and Puma and Reebok and all the rest? I mean, you're a competitive guy, and that comes through in this book, and you talk a lot about trying to overtake them. And now that you have, what does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, obviously that was the goal, and it feels good. But as I've said, I think I said in the book at least once that I hate losing more than I like winning. And at least right now, we're not losing.
Is the Nike story a story of design and function, or is it a story of marketing and brand building, both of which clearly you've got nailed?
Oh, I think we made a mistake early on to say that a company could, if it did two or three things really well, it could be successful. I think for a company to be successful in this day and age, that you got to do it all. And if you fail in kind of one area, including either finance and accounting, things that aren't very sexy, if you fail in those areas, you're not going to make it either.
The stripe on the side of the shoe. Tell me that story.
Well, when we changed from Tiger to Nike, we had to have a design for the shoe. And who do you go to? There's no dial 911 for design.
Especially not in 1975 or whatever.
So we basically, I'd been introduced to, or I introduced myself, I guess, to a graphic arts student at Portland State when I was teaching there. So we just called her up, or I called her up, and said, how'd you like to design a logo for a shoe? And so we went through a process, and she came up with several ideas, and we went back and forth over the course of a couple, 3 weeks, and came up with what is now known as the swoosh.
And she got, what, like $35 and a couple of hundred shares of stock once you guys went public, right?
She got, she was paid $2 an hour, which seemed to be the going rate for a struggling art student at Portland State, which amounted to $35 at the time. When we went public, we gave her 500 shares of stock, which she has held on to this day, and it's worth about $1 million.
Smart woman. You say in this book that you really wanted to call the company Dimension 6.
Well,
right?
Really
or
wanted.
Or that first Nike shoe, right?
That was my submission. That's a true statement. That we had 45 employees at the time we made the switch from Tiger to Nike, and we said, well, we don't have a lot of money to do research, and whatever name we pick, we'll just make it mean something. So all of the 45 employees stuck a name in the hat. The best I could come up with was Dimension 6, which fortunately my judgment was better than my creativity.
This is now a, what, $30 billion company. It's got 50-something thousand people working for you. What's the biggest thing you've done, do you think?
Well, I think the company itself, that, whatever my legacy is, it certainly dwarfed by anything. Nike dwarfs anything else I've ever done. And I'm real proud of it. I think a businessman can be an artist just as much as a writer or a sculptor. And so I'm real proud of what the company's become.
When you travel today and you see the swoosh and you see a Nike town or whatever it is, do you still get that feeling in you?
I do. I still look at people's feet and I get a thrill seeing it in unexpected places particularly. I know when the Berlin Wall went down and I walked across into what used to be East Berlin and saw two big Nike banners, that gave me a chill.
To the title of the book for a second, Shoe Dog. What is a shoe dog?
Shoe dog is a shoemaker.
That's it?
Pretty much.
Your dad is a big figure in this book and obviously a big figure in your life. If he could come back today and look at this company, what do you think he'd say? Because he had some doubts, right?
Oh, yeah, big doubts. And he made them well known. But he'd pop his buttons today.
Phil Knight is the co-founder and still the chairman of the board of Nike. Mr. Knight, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is Corner Office, a podcast from Marketplace. Thanks for listening.